You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
It's December 22nd, which is, I can't even believe 2013 has gone by, much less that in 3 days from now, I'm going to be sitting around a tree with a bunch of people giving and receiving gifts, which I will get sometime between now and 3 days from now. Let me tell you a secret, though. Here's how you know if a gift is good. Like, you know, if you're giving gifts to people, you want to know if they like it. Well, here's how you know. You know by whether or not they share it. Right? So we're going to be in a huge room full of people, and I'm going to have this ridiculous amount of gifts, I hope, stacked up in front of me. And I'm going to open them. If I open one and there's like some socks, I'm going to be like, oh, cool, I need some socks. I'm going to set them over here. And, everybody's just going to go about their thing. And if I open one and it's like, I don't know, if it's like $100 to Cafe Medici, I'll be like, whoa! Check it out, everybody! Not that they even care, but like, I love that thing, and I'm going to want other people to get in on my joy, because that's free coffee for like a week. I mean, that is an incredible gift. That's how you know a gift is good, is how much you want to share. It's in our nature to do that. You can hardly see a good movie, or hear a good song, or meet somebody that's cool, and not say to somebody, I met this really cool guy. You know, also, your association with him makes you cool, possibly. But that's just our nature. We share what we enjoy. This book that the Apostle John has written is like that. He's writing this near the end of his life, and it's his letter. It's his way of saying, like, I have received this most incredible gift. My joy is so full. I want you to get in on it. I want to share this with you. Now, if you're not familiar with John, here's the best thing you can know about John. He has a relationship with Jesus, which is marked by intimacy. He refers to himself as the disciple that Jesus loved. Not to like intimate that other disciples weren't loved or to put himself above them. It was just so part of his identity, so part of his experience with Jesus that that's how he referred to himself. He was close to Jesus. I don't know, if you ever get around somebody who has like such a quality of character or an expertise in some skill, those kind of people make you rethink your life, right? I watch a video of a 9-year-old playing some sort of Bach piece, and I'm like, what am I doing with my life? John's like that. I mean, his relationship with Jesus is so beautiful and so intimate and so powerful. When you read about it, when you read his letters, it makes you kind of rethink your life a little bit. Like, well, what is life really about? John's like that. And here John is humbly trying to share the secret to his life with us. He's trying to share his joy with us. In his letters that he wrote that you'll find right before the last book of the Bible, that's how he introduces it. He says, look, what I've seen, what I've heard, I now proclaim to you. I proclaim it to you because I want you to share in our fellowship. Our fellowship is with the Son and the Father, and I'm opening that circle up. I want you to come into that so that our joy might be complete. John's a generous gift giver. Now, the challenge for us as we receive this invitation from John, I think, is twofold. Some of you are brand new to church. Brand new to church, brand new to the Bible, brand new to Christianity. If I asked you to explain the Christmas story, you'd have a hard time with it. And so the whole prospect of like having an intimate relationship with a God that I can't see, who has a son that is also God, I mean, that whole thing is just really overwhelming. And so there is that kind of challenge of like, where do I start with this? It's like when you look up the definition to a word, but the definition has words in it that you don't understand, and you have to look up the definite. Some of you feel that way. You're like, man, you guys are using words like everybody's supposed to know what these words mean. It's confusing. Here's the other challenge, and it's kind of the other end of the spectrum, and it is some of you just have lots of familiarity with the Christmas story in particular, right? So even if you have this desire to get close to God like John, my guess is you probably wouldn't start with the Christmas story. Not because it's not powerful, it's really powerful, but because it's familiar, and so we tend to think there's nothing new there for us. But there's a mistake there, which I think John gets at. John would say over and over in his book that knowing something is radically different than believing. Believing involves knowledge, but Christian faith, Christian belief has a kind of active, pursuit, fervent beholding to it. It's beyond intellect. It involves intellect, but it's intellect that gets into our heart and comes to life. John's saying, if you want to know the true secret to joy and life and love, here it is. Behold Jesus, the Son of God. The author of Hebrews puts it like this. He says, look, picture the Christian faith like a race. And so it is active. You are moving toward a goal, a prize. And that goal and that prize is Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. So fix your eyes on him. And if you do that, your whole life will be caught up in that journey. That's what John's saying. We become what we behold, is how I would put it. We become like whatever we behold. There's a study that I read about, you ever known older couples who kind of start to act like each other? And when they get really old, they even start to look like each other. It's kind of weird. I was reading this study from the University of Michigan that was looking at that phenomenon. And here's how they explained it, which I think is pretty interesting. They said, when you are in that close of a relationship with somebody, you begin to imitate their facial expressions. You begin to sort of act and react the same way. And as you do, you literally change the form of your face through those expressions, such that as you're both doing that, you do end up looking more and more like each other in reality. You become what you behold. On the other side of it, you could think of the Lord of the Rings and Gollum. You know, his obsession with that ring changes him, doesn't it? Changes his physical appearance. Makes him all deformed and ugly. Makes him less of who he is. Drives him to insanity. All right, this idea that you become what you behold is not new. None of the studies that are out there about mirror neurons or anything like that is describing anything that's new. They're just describing something that we actually all intuitively know to be true. A reality that you become like what you behold. It's actually at the very core of Jesus' teaching. You look at the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5, and Jesus basically says, look, murder begins with hate. Adultery begins with lust. Robbery begins with greed. Because murder and hate and greed are all a kind of beholding self-interest. They're all a kind of beholding a sense of entitlement. And as we behold ourselves, we have a diminishing view of what it means that people are made in the image of God. And that produces things like murder and adultery and theft. All that to say, just knowing the Christmas story doesn't change you. All kinds of people know the Christmas story. It's not changing them. It's not altering the course of their life. If you want to be changed, if you want to have a relationship with God like John has with God, then you have to behold the Christmas story. You have to gaze at it. You have to let it sink in. Now, John's version of the Christmas story is designed to do just that. It's different than the other three, than Matthew, Mark, and Luke. The other three actually tell the events of Jesus' birth, and the meaning is kind of implicit in the text. John doesn't actually tell us the events. His is more of a theology of Christmas. The meaning is explicit because he wants you to behold the theology of the Christmas story. And we're going to look at his theology of Christmas just in a couple of verses, John 1, verses like 14 through 16. And we're just going to walk through those and begin to let John's version of things sink in a little bit. All right, so let's begin in verse 14. This is how John would summarize really all that he said up to this point. He says, the Word became flesh and dwelled among us. I don't think more meaning has ever been packed into so few words as this. The Word became flesh and dwelled among us. If you've been with us the last 3 weeks as we've been looking at this passage, then you kind of have a sense of what might be packed into this phrase. When John says the Word became flesh, he's tapping into the creation story. He's saying the Creator has condescended into creation. Sufjan Stevens says it this way, which is almost as good as John. He says, history involved itself. When you look at John's story, the Word became flesh. The Creator condescended into creation. He's taking you back to Genesis 1. That's why he begins with, in the beginning, because that's how the story begins in whole. And the story in Genesis 1 is that the earth is formless and void, and the Spirit of God is hovering over the deep. And God said, let there be light. Okay, so God, through his Word, which John will tell us is Jesus, creates. And so you have, in the first three words of John's letter here, this picture of the Trinity, the triune community of God, Father, Son, and Spirit, creating. And the first word of creation is, let there be light. And John says, the Word of God that is condescending into creation is coming like a light, and the light shines in the darkness. Verse 13, he says, the true light, actually 9 maybe, the true light which enlightens everyone is coming into the world. He's teasing it out, the Word, the light, because ultimately he's going to tell you what all that is. It's a person. The Word who was with God and who was God and through whom all things were made, the light, the true light, which has life in it, is becoming flesh. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. This is the meaning of Christmas. This is what the incarnation is. God, who is really God, the creator of all things, became man, who was really man, flesh. Now, this phrase, he dwelled among us, means literally he tabernacled among us, which is, we don't have tabernacles, but his readers would be very familiar with this imagery, because he's talking about when Moses had led the people out of slavery, and they're walking through the wilderness. God instructed Moses to build a tent of meeting, or a tabernacle. And God said, look, this is where I'm going to dwell. Right, I'm going to be in this tent, and you can come into this tent, and that's where I'll meet with you, and I'll talk with you. And so Moses would go into the tent, and everybody would watch, and people would go into the tent to meet with God. This is his place of dwelling. Let me read you from Exodus 33 so you can kind of get a sense of this. It says, Moses used to take the tent and pitch it outside the camp, far off from the camp, and he called it the tent of meeting, because that's where he met God. And everyone who sought the Lord would go out to the tent of meeting, which was outside the camp. Whenever Moses went out to the tent, all the people who would rise up, and each would stand at his tent door and watch Moses until he had gone into the tent. When Moses entered the tent, the pillar of cloud would descend and stand at the entrance of the tent, and the Lord would speak with Moses. And when all the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance of the tent, all the people would rise up and worship, each at his own tent door. Thus, the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face as a man speaks to his friend. This is what John's alluding to. The tabernacle, the place where God dwelt, was a place of meeting with God, of hearing from God, of speaking with God, of being with God. But John is saying the tent, the tabernacle, is a foretaste. In the Exodus text, God says, I will sanctify this tent by my glory. That's how it'll be okay to hold me. And John is saying, Jesus is the glory of God. John is saying, God talked with Moses like a man talks to a man, like face to face, but we'll see in a little bit, it's not literally face to face. And John's saying, in Jesus, God actually became a man, called us his friends face to face, literally. This is how you get the kind of relationship with God that John had. You get face-to-face. You get firsthand knowledge of God. So the question is, how do we do that? And John tells us in this next phrase, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And then John says, and we have seen his glory. And this little word, we have seen, means to behold. It means to look at with appreciation, to contemplate, literally to learn by looking, to fix your gaze on it. We don't become what we see, we become what we behold. And that's what he's saying here. We beheld his glory. Then he describes it. Glory as of the only Son from the Father. He's telling you what kind of glory it is because there are degrees of glory. Everything has its own kind of glory, right? Glory just, I use three words to describe glory. It's weight, it's value, and it's beauty. Right? If you kind of put all that together, that's the sense of glory. And so, you know, when a person who has, we would call it ethos, when they come into the room, everybody kind of takes notice. They have a weight about them. That's a certain kind of glory. When you look at a diamond or a precious gem, it has a kind of glory because we've assigned value to it. A sunset has a kind of glory because it's beautiful. All right, so you put all that together. That's what John's talking about when he says glory. Now, Jesus says that our default setting as fallen people is to glory in ourself, to seek our own glory. I've been troubled by this little phrase as we went through John 5 and 7. I didn't even really talk about it because I didn't know how to explain it. But in both of those texts, the people who are opposing Jesus, who don't see him as he is, the diagnosis he gives is he says that they seek their own glory. In other words, he's saying, if you are trying to establish your own weight apart from me, your own sense of value, your own beauty, and draw attention to your weight and to your value and to your beauty, well, you can't see me as I am. You can't behold the glory of God if you're preoccupied with your own glory. I came across an article from the Wall Street Journal. It must be a few years old now, but it's a man who doesn't have any faith to speak of or doesn't seem to. In fact, he kind of prides himself in believing all things, which is basically believing nothing. But he taps into this reality that we have this default setting, which is to seek our own glory. I want you to hear how he puts it. Let me find it. This is what he says. He begins by kind of describing a typical day that you might have. You go to work, you come home, you want dinner, you forget that you don't have any food, so you go out to the grocery store. On the way to the grocery store, some guy cuts you off. You get in the grocery store, and you know, you walk all around, you get up to the cash register, you forgot something, you gotta go back and get it, and then you come back. Now the line's long. You know, it's like everything's against you, everything is going wrong. And he's just like, this is every day. This is just what life has. And he says, now most of us, when we're not thinking, we all have kind of a default reaction to that kind of stuff, which is to be annoyed, to be frustrated, to be judgmental about all the people who are annoying and frustrating us. Here's what he says. Thinking this way is my natural default setting. It's the automatic, unconscious way that I experience the boring, frustrating, crowded parts of adult life when I'm operating on the automatic, unconscious belief that I'm at the center of the world and that my immediate needs and feelings are what should determine the world's priorities. See, there's a beholding of self that kind of is at the root of all of our frustration and judgmentalism. Now, he says, this is where the work of choosing comes in. And the whole article is about the freedom and the power to choose what you will behold. He doesn't use that word, but what you will think about, he says. He talks about the ability to consider alternative scenarios. You know, so for instance, maybe I have the choice to imagine that that guy who cut me off is rushing his child to the hospital and that helps me. He admits that that's not likely, but just having the power to think that kind of helps me not be so frustrated with him. Then he says, because if you can't exercise this kind of control, if you can't bring yourself to choose what you will think about, what you will behold, he says you'll be hosed in adult life. Then he goes on and he says, here's the deal. You get to decide what to worship. He uses that word, what to worship. And he says, because in the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is actually no such thing as atheism. There's no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. Now, he goes on. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough, never feel like you have enough. It's the truth. If you worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you'll die a million deaths before they finally plant you. If you worship power, you'll feel weak and afraid. And you'll need ever even more power over the others to keep that fear at bay. Worship your intellect, being sense of smart, you'll end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out, and so on. I mean, here's a guy who doesn't believe in any ultimate reality, any ultimate God, but he's tapped into this default setting we have to worship ourselves, and he's saying, it will absolutely kill you. I know that. You got to think about something else. On one level, he says, we all know this stuff already. It's been codified as myths, proverbs, cliches, epigrams, parables, the skeleton of every great story. Here's the conclusion. The trick is keeping the truth up front in daily consciousness. The way we're putting it is to say the trick is to behold Jesus above all else. John is saying that we see the glory that we see in Jesus surpasses every other glory. This is why the reference to Moses is so helpful. His readers would think of Moses as the one who saw the glory of God, because in a way he did. Moses pursued God like none other. There's a story where it's actually right after Moses goes in, meets with God. He speaks with God, but it's not enough. Right after that, Moses says, please show me your glory. And God's like, well, here's the deal. If you see my glory, you're going to die. And I like you, so we're not going to do that. Right? So here's the deal. I'm going to put you between these two rocks. I'm going to put my hand over it. I'm going to go by, and I'm going to say my name. I'm going to proclaim my name to you. And then as I go by, I'm going to lift my hand, and you're going to see the back, my backside. That's all the glory you can handle. And so that's what happens. He passes before him. Moses sees the backside of his glory. John's simply contrasting that story, what Moses saw, with what he saw and what we see in the person of Jesus. And if you look at verse 18, John takes this little jab at Moses. He says, no one has ever seen God. But if you're like a student of the scriptures, you're like, no, Moses saw God. And John's like, no, not really. Not like Jesus sees God, because Jesus is the only God. And then he uses this phrase that he makes him known. That, I don't know, the Greek word is he literally exegetes God. He narrates God. Jesus and the Father are one. He was with him for all eternity. Nobody's ever been up close with God like Jesus, because Jesus is God. And he narrates God. He explains him. He exegetes him. If you want to understand God, don't look at Moses. Look at Jesus. That's what John is saying. The Jews looked to Moses as this mediator of God's covenant, because he was that. He gave them the law, which is a very precious gift. It is a great grace to them. But it is a glory that is past in light of Jesus. I want you to look at this passage in 2 Corinthians 3. If you want to turn there, you can. We'll refer to it again in a minute. You know, John is basically preaching a little sermon on what happened in Exodus. Paul does the same thing here. 2 Corinthians 3, verse 7, Paul says, now, if the ministry of death, which is, he's describing the law, Moses' ministry of the law. If the ministry of death, carved in letters on stone, came with such glory that the Israelites could not gaze at Moses' face because of its glory. So when Moses went up to the mountain and God gave him the law, he came down and his face was glowing. He had to wear a veil because people, you know, couldn't, his face was so bright. So he's saying it was a glory. It was such a glory that it made Moses' face glow. But it was being brought to an end. He said, if that's being brought to an end, verse 8, will not the ministry of the Spirit have even more glory? For if there was glory in the ministry of condemnation, and the only reason he says that is because the law was meant to drive us to Jesus. But if you, in the law, try to establish your own righteousness, it will condemn you. You can't fulfill the law. You can't measure up to the law of God. So it has a ministry of condemnation. And if there was glory in that, the ministry of righteousness must far exceed it in glory. And he says that because Jesus does fulfill the law. Jesus lives the life that we should have lived, a perfect life. He measures up in every possible way. And the good news of the gospel is that when we have faith in him, when we put our trust in him, his righteousness is credited to our account. And we stand before God righteous. It's a great glory. It far exceeds the glory of the law. Verse 10, indeed, in this case, what once had glory has come to have no glory at all because of the glory that surpasses it. For if what was being brought to an end came with glory, much more will what is permanent have glory. Paul's point and John's point is that every glory that we might behold, even the glory of the law, even the glory of Moses, pales in comparison to the glory of God in Jesus. It's like the sun and the moon. The moon is beautiful at night, and you know this. The moon doesn't have any light of its own. It's simply reflecting the light of the sun. All these things that we see a glory in, whether it's money or power or relationships or things, whatever it is, they all do kind of have a glory of their own, but it's all derivative glory. They're all meant to be like the moon, to point us to the source of true glory. And so when we see something of weight, of value, of beauty, our default mode is to go after it like that is life. But those are God's road signs. Those are God's pointers to the glory in his son, Jesus. And so let me ask you, what has your attention these days? How long will that last, do you think? You know, we get our kids Christmas presents every year. We're trying to trim it down because the reality is they'll get these presents, they'll love it like they've never loved anything in their life for a day. I can't tell you how many Christmas presents we've put in garage sales and given to Goodwill and how many things they had to have. Right? I mean, look, we're like that. We chase things like it's going to be everything to us, and then there's another thing that'll be everything. And all of that is meant to point us to life itself in Christ. All right, let's move on. John describes this glory of Jesus, this glory that surpasses all other glories, as glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. What a beautiful description. Tim Keller poses an interesting question along these lines. He said, did you ever wonder how Jesus got people to believe that he was the Son of God? Which is pretty fascinating because, you know, the Greeks would have an idea of a concept of the gods coming down into earth. Eastern religions would have a concept of God being in everyone and therefore, you know, in earth. Jews believed in God. They believed in a God that was infinitely powerful and transcendent, meaning he was outside. He was other than us. They did not have a concept of God with us, in the flesh, no less. And so what makes it interesting is that Jesus would come to the Jewish people. That's how God would come. And for a Jew to say, I am God, is ridiculous. It's blasphemous. You get killed for that, which he did. But it's also just kind of astonishing that anybody would believe it. I mean, the disciples are Jewish people. How did he get them to believe that he was the Son of God? It seems impossible. Tim Keller says, you know, the only reasonable explanation is that when they looked at him, when they beheld him, and remember, they beheld him up close, day in, day out, 3 years. They watched him be tried. They watched him be tempted. They watched him be opposed and persecuted. They watched him interact with all kinds of people. They heard him teach. They saw it lived out when he wasn't teaching, you know, but never a false step. The only thing that makes sense is that when they saw that, you know, they asked, like, who is this that the water obeys him, the wind obeys him? Whoever taught with authority like this? Like, they asked all kinds of questions. And at the end of all those questions, the only reasonable answer must have been, he's God. They had the experience of the surprise of perfection because he was full of grace and truth. And they saw in him in all kinds of ways qualities coming together that they had never seen come together in a person. It was hard to explain any other way than that he was the only Son from the Father. They saw in him a tenderness without weakness, strength without heavy-handedness, humility without timidity, firm convictions yet utter approachability. And they just couldn't get their minds around what they were looking at. Must be God, full of grace and truth. Now, for the people who watch Moses go up on the mountain and the presence of God descend on the mountain. For them, God's glory was a consuming fire. God told Moses, set limits around the mountain because I'm going to come down on it. And if anybody touches the mountain, they'll be put to death. That was a hard word, but it gives you a sense of just the magnitude and the power of God's glory. That's what God's glory was for the people watching Moses up on the mountain. But the glory of God and his Son is full of grace. The people who touched the mountain died, like disintegrated, I think. Yet when Jesus is walking through the crowds, a woman who is desperate, who's been bleeding for 12 years, just touches the hem of his garment and she's healed. And Jesus feels the power going out from him, not the power that kills, but the power that heals. And he says, who touched me? And the text says that she came to the middle of the circle after a while, reluctantly, in fear and in trembling, because her concept of the glory of God is, you better approach this with fear and trembling. And Jesus tenderly looks at her and says, your faith has made you well. Go, you're healed. The glory of God in Jesus is full of grace. If you want to behold the glory of God, you got to get up close to his grace, because it's full of grace. I watched a movie the other night with my kids. We've watched no less than 13 movies this week because we've all had the flu. We're getting deep in the depth chart of movies that we can watch. Netflix is running out. So we watched a movie called Because of Winn-Dixie. Not guessing any of you have seen that. Maybe you read the book when you were a kid. It's about a little girl named Opal. And Opal's new to town. She finds this dog who she names Winn-Dixie. And their friendship leads them to all kinds of other friendships. And Opal begins to make friends with all kinds of people in the town. And one of these people she makes friends with, her name is Gloria Dump, is a fantastic name for this character. She lives on this like condemned piece of property that no kid dares goes into because they think a witch lives back there. She's unapproachable. Turns out she is this wonderful, wise lady. Well, Opal goes in there following Winn-Dixie and meets her, and they develop this relationship. Opal's trying to figure out the brokenness of the world and can't understand it. And Gloria Dump, the name is great, right? She lives in a dump, and she is this glorious person. And so she takes her out to this tree where she's hung all these bottles, and they're all liquor bottles. And she explains, you know, these are all memories of things I've done wrong in the past. And Opal says, but you're a good person. And she says, yeah, but good, I've done bad things. Right, so again, this glorious dump, in character of Gloria Dump. Now, at one point, they're sitting down, Opal and Gloria, and Gloria says to Opal this line. She's going blind, and Opal's asking her, can you see anything? And Gloria says, my eyes aren't so good. I can see the general shape of things, but I can see with my heart. And then she turns to Opal, and she says, now, tell me all about yourself so that I can see you with my heart. I think that's what it means to behold the glory of God. It means to get up close with God in his word and in any other way you can, and eagerly, desperately take in everything you can about him so that you can see him with your heart. If we do that, John says, not only do we behold his glory full of grace, we receive grace. That's the next line. The word became flesh and dwelt among us. We beheld his glory. Glory is of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. Then you get a little bit about John the Baptist. And then he says, and from his fullness, we have received grace upon grace. And so in our beholding, we not only see grace, we receive it. Let me take you back to that text in 2 Corinthians 3. Because this is where Paul ends up as well. He says, since we have such a hope, we're very bold, not like Moses, who would put a veil over his face so that the Israelites might not gaze at the outcome of what was being brought to an end. But their minds were hardened. For to this day, when they read the old covenant, the same veil remains unlifted, because only through Christ is it taken away. Yes, to this day, whenever Moses is read, a veil lies over their hearts. But when one turns to the Lord, right, when one lifts his eyes from what he thinks is glorious and beholds the glory of God and the Son Jesus, the veil is removed. Now, the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. Here's the verse 18. And we all, with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. You see, beholding the glory of the Lord, in doing so, we receive grace upon grace, and that grace changes us. John wasn't always like we read him to be. He was transformed because he was with Jesus. All of our intentions for change, all of our effort to change, you know why it never lasts? Because it's rooted in a beholding of self. And unless it's rooted in a beholding of Jesus, it won't bear the kind of fruit we want it to bear. This is why we must never tire of the gospel. This is why we have to push through our familiarity with the Christmas story so that we can see the glories in it. God, who was really God, became man, who was really man, so that we could have life. It is really life. Let's pray.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.